This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist anthropologist and the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative, and I'm also a current Soros Justice Fellow. Today's show, which I'm incredibly excited about, is about the Freedom in Captivity tour of their new performance, It's Hard to Talk About. Freedom in Captivity is a collaborative collective of folks who are impacted by our criminal legal system and other people who are concerned about that impact. We've been offering programming and events about the impact of incarceration on our families and communities for the past 5 years. And our most recent initiative is building an archive of stories about incarceration and then performing that archive to audiences across Maine. So today I am thrilled to welcome to the show Katrina Hoop, who's one of the performers in the show, and Nick Drake and Donna Drake, who were in the audience for the first performance in early October at Space Gallery in Portland. So Katrina, I'm going to come to you first. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, just say a little bit about who you are and how you came to know Nick Drake and Donna Drake.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Catherine. Thrilled to be here. My name is Katrina Hoop. I live in Portland. I'm an anti-carceral educator and sociologist. I am also on the board of Reentry Sisters, and I got involved with Freedom in Captivity through my experience volunteering in the many of the main DOC facilities as an educator. And so I joined the project after learning about it and being, introduced to the statewide initiative and sharing stories, as well as having worked with formerly incarcerated individuals and incarcerated students who had shared some of their own stories in the archive. And so I really wanted to be a part of this. And as part of my experience as a volunteer, that's where I met Nick. I'll pass it over.
Yeah, I'm Nick Drake. As Katrina was mentioning, I am a formerly incarcerated person. Unfortunately, I've been incarcerated multiple times in my life, but the most recent time was definitely the one that had the most positive impact, believe it or not. During that time, I was at the Maine Correctional Center, and I was able to attend college at the University of Augusta through internet courses. And Katrina was one of my professors. She came into the facility to teach a class. And then I was lucky enough, after being released, to be able to take another class with her online. And this is my mother.
Hi, my name is Donna Drake, and I am Nicholas's mother. Nick and I have been through a lot within the incarcerated system in the state of Maine. So I'm very honored to be here this afternoon to give my insight and whatever I can do to help incarcerated people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Katrina, Donna, and Nick, and welcome to the show. So I'm going to give just a bit of background before we talk about the performance itself, which is the topic of our show today. Freedom in Captivity was founded to raise questions about why we use incarceration to manage social problems and to respond to harm. Our programming over the past 5 years has been oriented toward exploring alternatives to incarceration that prioritize healing, accountability, and justice rather than just punishment and retribution. To do this, we've used the arts, we've used film, we've used classes and workshops, and we've used storytelling to get our message out. In collaboration with the Maine Historical Society and Colby College's digital libraries, we've now built an archive of stories from Mainers about how they have experienced our criminal legal system. The archive is called Freedom in Captivity, and it's publicly accessible through the My Maine Stories link at the Maine Historical Society and through the Colby College digital library system, and anyone in Maine can upload their own story. So as part of this project, Freedom in Captivity trained a group of story collectors who fanned out across Maine to collect the first 100 or so stories for the archive. And then a group of us curated some of those stories into a performance, which takes the form of a staged reading. We launched our performance with our first event in October at Space Gallery in Portland to a packed house. We got a standing ovation, very thrilling. So Katrina, I'm going to come to you. You're one of the performers, as you said. This project has been time-consuming. It's emotionally, I would say, wrenching. And so I'm curious if you can tell our listeners, first of all, why you signed on to do this. And second of all, what has been your experience, both of the script and of performing the script to a live audience? And what do you want people to get out of this performance?
So I signed on to be a part of this because it is just a powerful way, in my opinion, to share with the public what it's like to either be incarcerated or to have family and loved ones on the outside, you know, caring for people who are on the inside. And so it was sort of personal, but also professional to me. You know, I think that we hear a lot of figures and numbers are thrown around, you know, about the number of people incarcerated and statistics and rates and sentencing. But I think that, you know, it's really important to hear the personal stories, the qualitative, you know, if you will, behind these numbers. And this is what this performance does. And so it was just incredibly powerful. It has been all along in the rehearsals and in that performance, the first performance, to read words that resonate with so many people on both, you know, inside as well as outside. And in some ways, it's been therapeutic because, you know, people have lived through it. Many of the performers have lived through it. And then as I got to know my incarcerated students, I learned about their families, those people who cared about them on the outside. And I really began to kind of understand and deepen my understanding of what they've experienced. And so so for me, the performance has just been, you know, cathartic, you know, therapeutic, just healing, powerful, painful at times. And, you know, there's one line in it that I love just about sharing our stories that give us a sense of shared humanity. And I think of that as we read through it. And so what I really hope the public gets out of this, you know, observing is just a deep understanding of, you know, what's behind the headlines and what's behind the surface, and to really understand the shared humanity. So it's just been an incredible experience.
Katrina, I'm going to follow that up with another question. The phrase shared humanity, I'm wondering if you can dig into that a bit for us. What is it that you specifically mean by that? Yeah. Why is that such an important phrase for you?
Sure. Well, I think that there's this real strong narrative in our culture of like, you're either a good person or a bad person. Like you either harm or you receive harm, you know, or the target of harm. And I think that that's such a false binary, as many people have written about. And so, you know, when I think of shared humanity, I think that we're just all very complex individuals, and we all have, you know, there's all forces outside of us and through our histories and through our families that make us who we are. And everything, you know, so many ways that we respond to with our policies, with our laws, with our just general responses, just, you know, assume that people are simple or that, you know, a problem is simple. And it's just so much more deeper than that. And so I think, you know, for me, that shared humanity piece is really about, you know, how what a healthy society looks like is like really recognizing like the complexity of all of us and how we all, you know, play a role in helping create a really, truly genuine, healthy community and world.
And so part of what I'm hearing you say is an understanding shared humanity, the phrase gets at the fact that it's really complex to be a human being, and it's complex to work out our relationships of how we navigate living together, and that the binary, as you said, of there are good people and there are bad people is a false binary, perhaps a comforting one, but not a very helpful one and not an accurate one to describe this messy process of being human. And what you're hoping, I'm sort of putting words in your mouth, but yeah. I'm wondering if part of what you're hoping for the performance is a recognition of we are all complex. We all make mistakes.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And that redemption, you know, when you hear about people's trauma and their stories, that you understand that, you know, second chances are possible, that we're all worthy of redemption, as one of the lines in the play is that, you know, it's really about, you know, so many pieces, but especially about that, this redemption of like that deep within us is like this ability to care, and that, you know, and that we just need to find spaces, and including this performance, which I think is very healing for people who are listening, who have, you know, who've experienced trauma and harm and have been led in different directions. And so, yeah, that's really what I, what I think of when I think of this piece, this performance piece.
Thank you, Katrina. I'll come back to you with more questions, but I'm gonna pivot to Nick now. Nick, as a member of the audience, many of the performers are themselves formerly incarcerated, and they've been part of this project for, a year. You heard the script for the first time, sitting in an audience in a packed house. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the impact of it on you. How did you receive this script?
It was extremely moving, both in a positive and almost a negative way. I mean, there was lots of tears. There was lots of pain felt. But at the same time, there was a bit of a release and a bit of like self-acceptance. In those moments, as I was listening to these stories, and some of them, I knew these people. I could tell by some of the names that were mentioned and the stories that were being told that I was incarcerated with these men. And it was, number one, just great that their story was being heard. Some of them may never get out from behind that fence. So this is the opportunity for their story to be heard. But like I said, the self-acceptance piece, as I sat there and cried about it, it felt okay that I had this past. It felt okay that it was who I was, but it's not who I am today. And, with the title being, as you mentioned, it's not easy to talk about. It's not, in my life as I face society and I have people that I want to talk about that phase of my life with, it's very difficult. But when I was in a room full of people who have experienced similar feelings, similar experiences, all of a sudden it became easy and it felt normal. And I think that was the first time in my life that incarceration, or at least that phase of my life, felt normal to me.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. In fact, incarceration is a normal part of American life. One in three Americans will get entangled in the criminal legal system over the course of their life. One in two Americans have been incarcerated or had an incarcerated family member. That's pretty mainstream. That's pretty normal. And yet, as you say, it's hard to talk about because it has been so deeply, the history of incarceration has been so deeply stigmatized in our country, despite the frequency of it. You say that you felt maybe seen and heard and destigmatized a bit some of the stories you recognize. And I love the phrase that you say about some of the stories were told by people who will never get out, but their voices can get out. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Nick. Donna, the mother of somebody who's been incarcerated, you're in the audience and you're hearing these stories. And many of the stories are from people who have loved ones who are inside. How did the performance hit you?
It was quite emotional for me. Excuse me. I feel like I'm going to cry.
That's okay, Donna.
Nick and I have gone through a lot with his incarceration. And the part of that got me the most is when the performers were on stage and they were talking like they were talking on the phone to a loved one, and they were angry, they were upset, they were happy, and it just brought tears to me. I grabbed out and I had to hold on to Nicholas because so many times over many years, Nicholas and I had those kind of conversations. It's hard as a parent of an incarcerated adult to try and stay positive. The last thing that they need is for you to be upset. But sometimes the emotions overcome us. And when I watched those young people and those adults on that stage, it just took me to that place of where finally Nicholas has told me over the years, you don't understand, Mom, what it's all about. And it was almost like an opening of a door for me to hear it from other people, to see what their experiences were, and to see just how much in common Nicholas had with those people giving that performance. It was extremely powerful and emotional for me to sit there and watch that. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. This is Justice Radio, and today we're talking about the new Freedom in Captivity performance tour, It's Hard to Talk About. We're talking with Katrina Hoop, one of the Freedom in Captivity performers, and we're talking with Donna and Nick, who are in the audience for the first performance, about their experience of the performance. Katrina, I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to ask you, thinking about both the archive at the Maine Historical Society and the Colby College Digital Libraries and the tour itself, why is it even important to have these stories out there? Why is an archive of stories about the impact of incarceration something worth doing?
Sure. I think, as I've spoken about before with colleagues, and you know, from what I know of Maine, you know, you mentioned the stigma that surrounds incarceration. There really isn't a space, or many spaces at all, maybe perhaps a few, where we can really understand what it's like to be incarcerated, or for family members to share their, you know, their reflections on what it's like to have somebody behind bars. I remember when I was reading testimony in the legislature, just in stories written by people who are incarcerated, and how powerful that was. And I had never read that before. Once in a while, I'll come across in other states, you know, writings about by people who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. And so I think that when I think about Maine and what the kind of, you know, state and communities that we want to create, that's centered on healing, I think it's just so important to have this kind of repository of stories and a collection of just personal reflections, so that people can really understand and share even more, but understand what the impact that it has on the families and in these communities. So that's why I think it's really critical to have this, and to have this for the public.
And one of the reasons, you know, what I'm hearing you say is, without the voices and the stories of people who are impacted by a criminal legal system, it's very difficult to make sane policy that actually prioritizes accountability and healing about a segment of the population that has been stigmatized or silenced or disappeared. And I really appreciate that. Donna, I want to come back to you. The performance that we gave at Space had to be truncated a little bit because of the time slot that we were in. And one of the stories that we were not allowed to play was an audio story by a woman who was talking to her mom on the phone. She was incarcerated. She called her mom, and a prison guard walking down the hall hung up on her as he walked by, and he laughed just to be funny. And then he called lockup, and so she couldn't call her mom back. And so I think what that story gets at is the challenges that so many families face in trying to maintain communication. And if one of the things that really contributes toward rehabilitation is maintaining community relationships, maintaining family relationships, and yet that is something made so difficult by our carceral system, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts to share about that, since what you picked up on in the performance was the importance of those phone calls and the challenges of those phone calls. What are your thoughts about that?
It was difficult for me to begin that process with those phone calls. I didn't get much help from anyone there to even begin to a simple how to log in to getting a phone call to my son, being told that, oh, you're going to be delayed because I'm not sure if it was a guard that wasn't available for to go get Nicholas, or what the circumstance may have been. But there were several incidences where I felt that my son wasn't important and that I wasn't important, and that it was just a job to them. They were there to do what they were supposed to do. And at some times, a couple times, I felt it was they put the least amount of energy and effort into helping me as a parent try to connect with my son, and only for a 15-minute phone call. And that was one other thing that used to get me. They would watch that phone. There were a couple times where people were nice and would let us go a few minutes more. But for the majority, when that 15 minutes or 20 minutes was up, I remember once at least just being automatically shut off. I couldn't even say goodbye because the time was up. There you go. And there's a blank screen. And so then Nicholas would call me after that and I would ask him and he would say, you know, well, you know, the time was up and that's just the way it goes. So it is difficult to try and have that communication when you don't feel that they're there really to help you connect with your loved one. Yeah.
Thanks, Donna. I do think that comes through clearly in many of the stories in the performance are about parents trying to maintain a loving connection with their children and finding that so incredibly difficult. Coming to you, Nick, can you talk to us a little bit about why it's important for people on the inside to be able to maintain a connection with their family?
Oh, man, for me, to put it simply, I guess, is because there's a part of you or a part of me, I can't really speak for everyone, but there was a part of me that didn't want to accept that prison was my life. And like that was all my life was being told when to get in my room, being, you know, staying in a cell with a locked door, being told when to eat, when I could shower, when I could go to church. Like that is in reality what I had to live. But if I wouldn't have been able to reach out and talk to my mother or, you know, a couple of friends, or a couple of mentors from church, if I didn't have that connection, I would have felt lost in the sense that prison would have been my life. There would have been no other part of me that had any effect on anything in the world. There would have been no sense of purpose because it's just routine inside those walls. And while I did what I could to try to create positive impact while I was there, I still was a victim of that routine. So without being able to reach out and say I love you to someone, without being able to have a visit and hug a loved one, I mean, outside of handshakes and occasional fist bumps, any other physical touch of any kind is forbidden within those walls. So if I wouldn't have had visits, then potentially I wouldn't have hugged anyone for 5.5 years in, you know, my longest time in. And I'm a hugger. So I don't know. I don't know if I would have been able to survive that, to be honest. So that connection is probably the most important part.
Yeah, that really got to me. Thank you. That was beautifully said. Katrina, I'm going to come back to you. You've taught on the inside. You have developed relationships with families on the outside whose children are incarcerated. I know that that's important to you. You maintain a connection with some of your students once they've been released. You're a mentor. You're a support person. Going back to the performance, if I were to ask you to give a public service announcement about why people, maybe who have got nothing to do with the criminal legal system, people who say, I don't know anything about that. I don't know anybody incarcerated. Nobody in my family's ever been incarcerated. Why would I want to watch that? What would you say to them about why they might want to think about coming to a performance?
Gosh, you know, I think I would probably frame it as just, you know, think of somebody that you care deeply about, you know, a child or a close relative or a brother or, you know, mother or, you know, some close relative that you care deeply about and imagine them, you know, having to be far away from you, you know, in a prison setting and not having many people to talk to about your pain and struggle, you know, try to imagine what that might feel like. That's where, when you come to hear these stories, the messaging is so powerful, is so incredible to hear, you know, that even if you personally have never experienced this, you know, so many people have or are experiencing or have, you know, have experienced it. And it's possible that you know, somebody that you know close to you doesn't share with you what's sort of going on in their lives. There's that much stigma. And so, and as you mentioned earlier, Catherine, you know, 1 in 3, you know, people have had experience with the criminal legal system. 1 in 2, either, you know, themselves or somebody in their family, there's a really good chance that someone near you has experienced this. And so I think I would start there, you know, just someone close to you, and then just imagining what it would be like to, you know, love across walls, you know, to care for someone across walls.
Thank you, Katrina. Donna, I'm going to come to you with the same question. What would you have to say to somebody who says, I don't need to go watch that?
First of all, I would say to them, you're lucky. It's a very painful experience for a family member to have a loved one literally torn away from your arms, and you have no one else really to talk about that experience. The only other people that I felt comfortable talking to were the other family members of inmates on visit days. There were a couple women that I formed, I would say, close relationships with. Unfortunately, after their loved ones were released, those friendships fell off. But people really do need to think that just how fortunate they are in their lives, how special it is. So many people, I think, take for granted the love that they have with their family members, thinking that every day I'm going to get to see them, or I'm going to pick up the phone and say, hi, how are you? Or do you want to go out and grab a drink? Those are the people that need to really realize to look at something like this, to understand what it's like for those of us that are parents of incarcerated and incarcerated people themselves, that they just don't have that opportunity. And they need to give it some really hard thought to just thank God that they're not in that situation.
Thanks, Donna. Nick, we have time for one sentence. What would you tell somebody to get them to suggest that they should come?
I would echo what Katrina was saying towards the beginning of this interview, this idea of shared humanity. There's too much division in this world right now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the way we all get through it is to recognize that we're all humans. We're all dirty. We all have baggage. We all struggle. And if we struggle together, it's easier for everyone.
Yep. Thank you so much. If you're curious about attending a performance, you can go to www.freedom-captivity.org and take a look at our performance schedule. November 7th, we're in Lewiston at the Franco Center. November 8th, we're at Ellsworth at the Grand. That evening, we're at Steuben at Tunk Joy Bakery. On the 9th, we're at the Castine Historical Society. On the 22nd of November, we're at York Public Library in the afternoon and Meeting House Arts in Freeport in the evening. And on Sunday, the 23rd, we're at First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church in Portland. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, to Aaron Pyle, our sound engineer, and to Daria Cullen, our executive producer, we are Justice Radio.